Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Curzon Cinema Podcast, where we will be discussing Matteo Garrone's fairy tale anthology, Tale of Tales. I'm Sam Howlett and I'm joined by Helen Seymour.
Hello.
And Ursi Kalitzi.
Hello.
Good to have you both on the show. We also have not one, but two interviews today. One with Matteo Garrone's and it's the film star, Toby Jones. We'll be showing those in a minute, but first just to introduce the film. So, Tale of Tales... Were you shown three quite tenuously connected stories, would you say? Their links are quite broad rather than clear.
Linked through theme.
Through theme, it's a good point, yeah, rather than like Pulp Fiction. It's not like the characters overlap as much as they would in that.
Yeah.
So you've got the flea, the queen, and the two old women. And it's based, loosely based on the stories by Guillaume Battista Basile.
Yeah,
have I pronounced that correctly?
Are you going to read the title?
That's the author.
You going to read the title?
No.
Well, no, it's the I read it.
The Pentameron, I think.
Oh, yes. There's another one that
has the
words.
Yeah, yeah. Words. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
I read it earlier and I was like, I wonder if they're saying that on the show.
Yeah, it's,
you can Google it.
One of its
listeners.
Italian translations is slightly racy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For us.
Okay, so let's get straight in. So Jake met up with Matteo Garrone's a few weeks ago in London, and here is his interview. Enjoy.
So we are thrilled to be joined on the Curzon Cinemas podcast with Matteo Garrone, director of Tale of Tales. How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm fine.
Excellent. So Tale of Tales is adapted from Giambattista Basile's Pentameron, a collection of stories not well known in England. Could you give us some background on that collection?
Yeah, it's the first book of fairy tales ever written in Europe in the 17th century. So this book is a masterpiece of the Italian literature and inspired all the famous writers of fairy tales like Brother Grimm, Andersen, Perrault. And unfortunately, it's not well known also in Italy. So it was a great opportunity for me to take this material and to try to make an adaptation for a movie, because it was material that was new also for the audience. There were some tales very famous because, for instance, Basile is the first who write about Cinderella. But I choose some story that were quite unknown. And we decide, because there were 50, so it was difficult to choose. Then we decide to three from the point of view of a woman in three different age.
Okay. And because fairy tales are so much associated with childhood, were these stories that you grew up with yourself, or were you finding them in later life as well?
Well, when we start to write the script we immediately knew, because the book, it's quite dark, you know, it's sometimes it's like horror in a way. So it's for not for kids, but for an audience that is from 13, 14 years old and older. Because at that time, in the 17th century, Basile wrote this story for entertainment, an audience, but not there was not literature for kids at that time. So this story have a base medieval, but so that's why it's so also dark. But they were written not for kids, you know, but for a transversal audience. And that time, Basile was in the period of Shakespeare, so there was some connection on the atmosphere of his tales. Italo Calvino used to say that the tales of Basile remind a sort of Shakespeare Napolitan, you know. So there was something in common in a way. So it's very sometimes very dark.
That makes a lot of sense, because at about 13, 14, that's where in England we would start studying Shakespeare. You don't really read it up until that age.
Yeah, yeah,
and
exactly.
It's got that similar feel to it.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we touched on it earlier. The stories that you chose, you mentioned that it was tackling female characters at different stages in life.
Yeah.
Could you expand on why you selected those for that reason?
Yeah, well, honestly, it was not easy to make that decision, because there were also other stories that were really beautiful. Sometimes you know that you make decision because, for instance, there was another story that was bigger than this, so it would take just 1 hour, 1 hour and 20, just one. So we decided these three because they were more organic, and also the theme of this story were very modern, because Basile talks about you know, lifting and aesthetic surgery in the 17th century. It's amazing, you know, if you think so, about the beauty, about how it's important for an old woman to try to be young and beauty, you know, and the desire of another woman to be mother, and the problem that she has because she can have a baby, or the conflict between a father and a daughter. So the theme are very contemporary in a way, because tales talk about human archetype. So that's why are always modern. When I made this movie, it was 17th century, but for me it was a movie shoot of people of now. So my approach was like if I was making a contemporary movie.
Mm. And there's that, the theme that links all of the stories together is that selfishness of desire, and the repercussions of that. It didn't need to be a flea or a sea monster, it could be anything really.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely
just a vehicle to express that.
Absolutely, absolutely agree.
And was the plan always to slightly link the stories together, that they would all intertwine? Did you always come up with it with that?
Yeah. We want to have a structure that gives the idea that are three different plays, but in the same world in a way. It's this world of fantasy in a way. The structure is similar to my other movie, to Gomorrah. Also, if they look a little bit different on the approach, but also in Gomorrah there were many different stories, and then we choose three or four or five, and then we mixed together. So since the beginning we decide on, when we were working on the script, to mix in this way the story.
And you mentioned the world in which everything takes place. It's got a very distinct aesthetic. You've got that 17th century time frame of when it was written. But what about the look of the whole world? What were the inspirations behind that?
Well, we spent like 8 months to travel from the south of Italy to the north to look for location. And then we decide at the end to choose for the some region of the south, some Sicily, Puglia, and then also in Lazio, close to Rome, and Tuscany. And we choose a location that we thought could be the best for tell about, because for me location, it became a new character in the story. It helped to understand the conflict of the character. So, for instance, in the story of the flea, it's important that the castle is isolated, so the daughter can feel the loneliness, no, to be there. And it was important on the story of the two old sister and Cassel that the castle has to be vertical, you know, so that they are below and he's on the top, you know. So every story gives an idea of the landscape that you have to find, you know.
And these are all real places. These are real castles that you found.
Yeah, well. Yeah. We look for a real castle, real landscape, but at the same time, also sometimes this place has to give the idea that it's also something like built in the studio in a way. So like also theater aspect of this. We wanted to make a sort of homage to the beginning of the cinema, like Méliès movie. So if you think to the scene when the sea monster, there is a fight between the king and the sea monster under the water, it's like a Méliès movie. Yeah. So you can feel that is an approach also with the special effect, very materic, you know, very realistic in a way. Yeah. We don't use the digital too much. We don't.
And the flea, that was puppetry,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah. We have this approach, like art craft approach, you know.
There are quite a few changes that you make to the original text, would you say?
Something, because, you know, when you read, is something, it works when you read, but if you put in image in adaptation for cinema, maybe can looks unbelievable, you know. So if you, so we take out something, we change, but we didn't betray the soul.
No.
Of the story.
One element that I noticed was in the story of the flea, the princess kind of, rather than ending up as a victim, she almost becomes a hero at the end as well, and she saves herself.
Yes.
Which I thought was really...
Yeah, that in that story we wanted to work also on the humanity also of the ogre in a way, because he won the princess, so he is right, you know. And so I like when there is not good and bad, but human being that fight for survive, you know. And that's my approach always in all my movie is always very human. I try always to create a relationship with the character, to love the character, and always to be beside them, to don't judge from the top, you know, but be beside them and to live emotionally their journey and their conflict, you know.
And when you're editing the film, because you've got three stories, it could be quite tempting to cut between them very quickly so the audience remembers what's going on in all the stories.
Yeah.
But you give each one a bit more time to breathe. And how did you approach when to cut between each segment?
Well, when we wrote the script, we already start to create this cut, you know. Then We didn't change a lot on the editing, because for me this is the first movie that was more structured compared to the other. Mm. First of all, because there were a lot of special effects, so you need to organize everything before. I used to work with more improvisation in my other movie, and also because this was my first movie in English. So it was probably also more, and I work with stars, big stars. So I used to work in sequence in my other movie, sequence from the beginning to the end. So it's easier also to change, because you follow a journey of the character. When you work with big stars, you can't, you know, shoot in sequence, because they have other You know, they are busy. They can stay 4 days in the hotel waiting for the. Also because it's very expensive otherwise to keep them in 4 days in the hotel. So it was a movie more structured compared to my other, but it was a new experience. So after this movie, I feel like I can do everything, you know.
And it's clearly a very ambitious film. Do you think that there was a certain HBO fantasy TV series that helped get the idea off the ground?
Oh, you mean if I get some idea from some TV series? Or
yeah, from Game of Thrones being so popular now. Do you think that helped getting the project off the ground?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe. But I like it. I like it very much. But I think that is something different, honestly. It's something different. But I liked very much, especially the first series, the first part. I like it very much. And I know probably this Tale of Tales is not a fantasy, but it's a movie about fairy tales, because it's also the background where these kings lives is real. It's not something completely, you know, invented. So that's probably different from the fantasy movie, you know. It's more the for me, my first reference, because I was a painter, probably that's why my first reference is Goya, the drawings of Goya, Los Caprichos. In that drawings I found all the soul of the tales of Basile. Also, if Goya arrived 2 centuries after Basile, but there is this dimension of grotesque, this the character, a human, a comic, a tragic, and I found visually the atmosphere of the tales of Basile in this drawing. So I was in my office, there were always everywhere these drawings. Then when I start to shoot, I try to forget everything, to find my personal journey, my personal way to make this movie.
Excellent. Matteo Garona, director of Tale of Tales, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, nice to talk to you.
Okay, so that was the film's director, Matteo Garona's there. So I don't know how you want to do this. So let's introduce the three stories.
Yeah.
Should we start with? So, you want to do that? So start with The Queen.
So, yeah, The Queen, the original story is called The Enchanted Doe. However, it's not really included in the story, but it's a king and a queen who really want an heir, but she is unable to conceive. And then an old soothsayer comes to the palace and says that if they hunt down a sea monster and take out its heart, mm-hmm. and then subsequently cook it, a virgin cooks it specifically, then the queen will give birth in 24 hours, which is something that you do see. And as a side effect, the virgin that cooks it also gives birth as well to basically identical twins.
Okay.
And the friendship and love that the twins have for each other, even though I'm not aware, I don't think that it's made clear if they know their link or not, makes the queen very jealous.
Okay.
And their friendship is kind of interrupted by her.
Yeah, I think this is kind of the main story in a way, because it starts the film and everything sort of almost stems off from this one. And this is the poster is obviously of Selma Hayek, who plays the queen, about to eat the heart, and that's I think it should become quite an iconic image.
Absolutely.
It's quite a striking, this big blood red heart with completely white background, and Selma Hayek in the middle about to eat it with it smeared around her mouth.
Did you hear her? She was on Graham Norton's show talking about it.
Oh, okay.
And she was eating it, she was saying, but guys, like, what's in it? Like, what am I eating right now? And they just kept saying, it's nothing you're allergic to, just and she, like, apparently they had made like ventricles out of spaghetti.
Nice, that sounds great.
But I think other things, it was disgusting apparently.
Oh, right. So the next story, I guess, would be The Flea. This is one with Toby Jones.
I love The Flea.
The Flea's great, yeah. And it's about a king in the... King of High Heels, it's called.
Yeah.
He's fascinated by a flea, which he feeds, and it grows to a bizarre size. The size
like
of a donkey. Yeah.
Size, yeah.
And then...
Donkey.
Yeah, it's like the size of a donkey. And then, I don't know, it's a random animal to think of.
I like it.
And then there's also this thing of that whoever can guess the hide of the flea gets to marry his daughter, and the story stems from there. And then the final story is The Two Old Women, which is originally called...
The Woman Who Skinned Herself, or The Flayed Woman.
This was the craziest story.
this was my favourite by far.
It's my favourite as well, actually.
Yeah. Oh, I'm...
Your flea, Team Flea.
Team Flea.
So, well, I think what I love about The Two Old Women is what I love about the film overall is that it really feels like an adult fairy tale. And I think throughout the whole film, without spoiling it too much, you're dealing with themes of sex, rape, murder. So it's like complex themes and mature content. I mean, were you shocked by seeing these themes dealt with in a fairy tale landscape?
I wasn't surprised, because I always deemed that fairy tales should always be. They were always meant to be gory, because their end goal is to instill a message and morals. There's a moral to the story, even though Basil's original kind of stories, they were never meant to be for kids, because the genre hadn't been invented at that point. So these were meant to be for the courts, because they used to do kind of discuss fairy tales amongst each other. And the fact that it was gory, the fact that it dealt with envy, desire, spoke a lot more of the human condition than what you would have in fairy tales made from Disney, for example, which are neutered, I would say, in a way. And this is... I was very happy that Garrone kind of took that on, because he is great at doing that. He is great at dark fairy tales. Like, his previous film was Gomorrah, and he describes that as a kind of dark fairy tale about the human condition. And I was absolutely kind of very happy to see that he was very real. Like, there was hyper realism and gore and blood and everything. It was great.
Helen?
Agreed.
Excellent. Great. Yeah, it was nice to see that this kind of world was dealing with real themes. I mean, well, Jake, in the interview, Jake mentions Game of Thrones and, like, the fact that fantasy is really popular at the moment. I actually saw this being less fantasy and more surreal. I think so, because
really
the the fantasy elements, like the giant flea, and there's also a sea monster.
And the ogre.
The ogre, there's elements of magic. They're all unquestioned. The characters, like, everything's accepted. It's not like, oh my god, this is crazy. And it's not like Game of Thrones is very much, it's like, creates a world with rules. This doesn't really have its own rules, or it isn't about creating a universe. It's just like all fairy tales, everything sort of exists in this one story, and it's not about questioning the magic, it's just accepting it and thinking about what that means for the characters, which was dealt with really well, I thought. Okay, well, I also want to talk about the look of the film. It's kind of a really nice combination, I thought, of sort of, you've got gothic fairy tale elements, but also like Mediterranean architecture. Like, it looked like it was in like Spain or Italy, but also had this medieval feel. I mean, do you agree that it sort of balanced those two kind of aesthetics well, or?
Most of them, the general visuals of the film itself, I think, were very much like a painting.
Yeah.
Because you have the contrasting colors. Red plays a massive part in this film. And so does white as well, because the twins that the queen has are albino. And they look like their biological father, which is the sea monster, in a way. And then you have the colors of that contrast between each other. So when the old woman becomes young again, is enchanted by the other old woman. It's plenty of old women. And her hair is red.
Yeah.
The bed sheet.
Yeah, exactly. That she's wrapped in contrast with the green that is very vivid. And it all looks like a painting. It all looks like something that could have been done in Neapolitan era. And Garrone was also influenced by Goya as well. So the crones that you see are very much like a satirical drawing, very heightened kind of makeup. And The king as well, played by Vincent Cassel,
yeah,
I thought was very good because he looks haggard. You wouldn't think that he's a magnificent looking king who could sway any woman off her feet. Mm-hmm. There's flaws in everyone.
Yeah.
Same as Salma Hayek as well, because sometimes she contorts her face in a way that kind of is like...
Yeah.
You would ordinarily be a very wonderful, beautiful looking woman, but sometimes what you do and how your face reacts to things makes you feel very kind of uneasy.
The scene of her eating the heart as well, she eats it very messily, like the blood gets all over her face, it's really unflattering. And I thought that was great to see, like, someone not just using their looks, as perhaps another Hollywood film might have wanted her to do.
Yeah.
So we've mentioned a couple of times about the flea and the sea monster, which are done with pretty much entirely practically, which you don't see very often, which was really great. And I thought looked so much better than they would have if they were CGI.
Yeah.
It's also something Guillermo del Toro-y about the creatures in this film, I thought, and of the look in general, that kind of realism combined with fairy tale and fantasy.
Yeah.
Yeah, great
Guillermo
balance
Guillermo del Toro, actually, now that you mention it, is a very kind of... is a great supporter of fairy tales having this gory element to them. If you look at something like Pan's Labyrinth,
Devil's
which
Backbone,
is a fairy tale, it's also a horror film because there needs to be... It's violent desires are only achieved through violence, which is a great line from the film. I absolutely love it. And I think it's very... You need that in a fairy tale. You can't just... It can't be happy endings all over the place, you know?
Excellent. Before we have the interview with Toby Jones, just a second, I just want to ask about how you think the film balanced its three stories, because anthology films, for me, sometimes you get the thing of you always prefer one story to the other, and sometimes you think, I'd rather just see this story as its own film. How do you think the film dealt with that angle of having three stories in one?
In this one, I didn't really... I do that thing as well of being like, oh, I'll go back to the other one, that one's good. But I didn't do that in this one. I totally got sucked into the world. And once I was in it, it took a while because it was so strange, you know, to kind of find comfort in it. But once I was in it, I was just so, all of them, I loved them all. Like all the stories, I was just so happy to watch it.
Yeah, absolutely agree. It's kind of like a Simpsons Treehouse of Horror.
In many ways. But I think it also, it's the whole thing of...
Pop that on the poster.
Oh, yeah.
the original book has like 50 fairy tales, and I think they chose they chose the ones that bookend one of the last chapters of the entire book, of the first day. There's a whole backstory to the entire Tale of Tales thing. But having a triptych, basically.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Having a triptych of any film, I think, is great, because also when you're dealing with that kind of subject of humans and desire and envy, number three is always a very significant number. So if they hadn't done any more, or they had tried to kind of bring in other elements of the rest of the fairy tales of the book, I think it would have cluttered so much.
Collapsed on itself. Just be too heavy for someone to watch that many things unfolding at once. And it's not like...
And it's a difficult world to comprehend.
Absolutely. And it's not like you see one story, then another. they're overlapping, like you see a bit of one, a bit of the next one, a bit of the third one, a bit of that. They cut back and forth, and I thought that was the editing was really well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you had just the amount of time in each one, and sometimes you had like 1 2 3 2 3 1 3 2, that kind of thing,
like a musical composition.
Yeah, basically. Absolutely. Yeah,
you know, like, your alto, and then you go back down again. Yeah. And it's really good. Yeah,
yeah, really well balanced. Yeah, really, really fun as well. Thing. Can we talk about how fun this film is? Yeah.
You can tell it's Monty Python sometimes in it. You can tell that the humor is just there, and it's amazing. It's so funny. And the stories themselves, I was very happy that he transposed their humor to the film, because there were times where I was like, I can't believe I'm laughing at this. This is a horror film where I'm having so much fun.
It's quite a jet black humor at times as well, definitely.
Yeah.
So, Toby Jones, one of our country's greatest actors at the moment.
I love him.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
He plays the King of High Heels in the film. His character takes place in the story of The Flea. And, Jake Cunningham, our intrepid producer, went to interview him. So here the interview is. Enjoy.
So we're delighted to be joined on the Curzon Film Podcast with Toby Jones of Tale of Tales. So, Toby, in the film, you play a king who raises a flea to the size of a donkey, skins it, and then sells his daughter to an ogre. An easy one to get into character for?
Careful of the spoiler alerts on that one. I mean, a very easy one to get into, because I'm a father of two daughters. I don't have any relationship with fleas, but I have a relationship with, I suppose, my own failings as a father in terms of being negligent in terms of time and being distracted, easily distracted. And I think in a way the flea represents that in the film on some level. So I don't have any direct relationship with fleas on whatever scale. I do have a relationship with what flea represents.
Okay. And did you read the original story from Pentamerong before you tackled it?
I didn't. There wasn't, where I was, I was filming something in Canada at the time, and there was no access to that, to either the internet or the book. So I was depending on Matteo's screenplay. That was my main source, my only source material. So I wasn't able to look at the original script. But in a way, that didn't bother me too much, because the way Matteo talked about the story and what he'd done with the story, it seemed very clear. I mean, the story itself, although strange and fantastical and macabre, it's very straightforward. It's, you know, it's unidirectionally, these things happen one after another. It's just that what happens is so strange.
And could you tell us how the flea scenes were actually shot, and any challenges that they brought about for you? Because I imagine that's not a normal situation to be in as an actor.
No, I mean, obviously the flea goes on this journey itself. The flea grows and grows up. The first flea you don't see is the tiny flea that we all know, you know, from fleas that we've encountered in the world, which is practically invisible. And that we shot that without any, it was me basically acting with an invisible flea. And although that was a challenge, I realised, you know, there I was in Italy shooting this scene, which is actually a very classic Lazzi from Commedia dell'arte, which is when Harlecchino fights a fly, is bothered by a fly with his sword. And that in the theatre triggers him to do acrobatics, and in the traditional Commedia dell'arte you would see that. And here, in a way, it's a kind of reference to that, because here you have a king who's not fighting with the flea, but sort of juggling with it. And that was kind of nice, that to have a sort of reference point from the Italian theatre, which I had studied a bit. Then, as the flea grows, they had different kinds of puppet and different kinds of puppeteers operating both on the different scales and then within the flea itself as the flea becomes sort of huge. And that wasn't, that was fantastic, because normally one's used to working with tennis balls and green screen, and to have actual maquettes there to work with was really useful.
Yeah, kind of the early stages of the flea kind of reminded me of the kind of vaudeville flea circus, and you happen to be part of that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's comic, and it sort of sets up a comic childlike thing in the king. The story is all about who is the child, where is childhood, what one does with childhood in a way, and how childhood is about play, and then there comes a time for things to become serious. And obviously my story is intertwined with my daughter and her rite of passage with the ogre.
Yeah, because the king has a sense of childishness and innocence at the start of his trajectory, and that drastically changes throughout. And do you think that's part of the recognising his obsession?
Yes, I think that often you know the foibles of a king in a fairy tale, there's a side of a king that can be very, very dangerous. If a king doesn't grow up, if a king doesn't mature, they can become tyrannical and whimsical and erratic if they don't, you know, if a king is not fully mature, is not wise. And here you have a king who doesn't grow up for whatever reason. We don't know why that is. Whereas his daughter does grow up, and in a way you see this reversal in the final shot of the film, of the story, where she has become queen and he has become almost like her child. And there's lots of resonance in that about how, as a parent, you will in time become your child's child.
Mm. And do you think interpreting the mentality of the king like that allowed you to penetrate it more easily, rather than thinking about it as a man who's growing a flea?
Yes, I think so. I took the story to be about parenting. That's what it's about someone being distracted, and also nostalgic in a way. That, you know, most parents, I've got kids, and it's a totally human foible, failing to live in the child's past, because you know that already, and all your fears for the child's future, and you love your children, and the future is unknown. So there's a strong tendency to try and fix them in time, in a when they want to grow, and the child is all about the future, and you're all about trying to secure them, which means fixing them in time. And I know those feelings as a parent, and they felt very familiar to me. So as strange and as exotic as this tale seems, it feels very familiar to me, the themes in it. It doesn't feel so bizarre as to be like a surreal tale. It feels more domestic in a way.
And I think that can be seen in the story of the queen as well.
Yeah,
that relationship of desire for a child's future actually not perhaps being the greatest thing for them.
Exactly, and you see with the two old women, their desire for youth. You know, their desire to rejuvenate themselves, and the disastrous consequences of that, and sending them into a kind of madness. Superficially, the film seems to be, you know, people constantly saying, "Oh, it's bonkers! It's crazy! This strangeness is so, oh, it's grotesque!" And clearly, that is true. That there are elements in it that we know are sort of these weird sort of extremes that we associate with the fantastic, but deep down, not very deep down, there is they're very domestic, instructive stories. But it's just that they tell their messages very obliquely, and as in all fantastic literature, they seem disproportionate. The darkness and light seem disproportionate.
And speaking of the other stories that come with the film, other than one scene, you don't interact with the other stories yourself. How much did you know about the queen and the two old women whilst you were working on the film, or before going into it?
Obviously, I'd read the whole script. When I first talked to Matteo, I realised, oh, I thought we might all be shooting them concurrently. But he was going to shoot them almost as separate films with these two interlinking scenes. One is a funeral and one is the climactic scene where we see the surviving characters together, united by the spectacle of a tightrope walk, which is interesting. But his ambition, and he's an extraordinarily ambitious director, was to shoot these films all over Italy. So we didn't really meet each other. So I worked with Bibi and Guillaume in Puglia, and other bits of the film were shot in Sicily and Tuscany, and you see parts of Italy you can't believe still exist, you know.
Did you feel like you were getting taken back to the Berberian studio de la post-production?
Exactly. Well, yeah, not that one. I mean, obviously that film was shot entirely just outside the Olympic Park in East London in a studio. But yes, certainly the culture of Italian filmmaking is refreshingly chaotic in a way that often ours is kind of cold-bloodedly industrial. You know, it's very systematized, and there is room for a certain amount of creative chaos to happen when you're filming, and that is obviously familiar from Berberia.
And so Matteo, as a director, he's got to maintain a certain amount of outlandishness on set but contain it as well, give it a sense of order so everyone knows what's going on. What does that set feel like?
Well, for the first time, I think he's working with... Normally, he's operating his own camera, and he's the cinematographer as well. And here, he's working with Peter Sujitsky, who's worked with David Cronenberg, who's a very, very, you know, on the face of it, deals in a similar kind of oddness, but is a very different sort of kind of director. And I think that juxtaposition of Peter's very studied... beautiful cinematography, where these beautifully composed images. I think Peter and Matteo are from very different areas of the film business, and I think that was very interesting on set. That tension between them, not always content. You know, a lot of debate about it, and a very different personalities.
And with such precision taken in the art direction and the gothic look of the settings, did it ever feel imposing to be at the centre of?
What do you mean in terms of?
So, for instance, some of the sets are quite heavy and foreboding, and being amongst that, how does that affect your performance?
Well, when we were shooting Castel del Monte in Puglia, I couldn't believe the beauty of this castle in the middle of nowhere, and you could look out, and the landscape was largely unchanged since the Middle Ages. You could believe yourself in that landscape, and certainly on the top of the castle, no health and safety or anything. So when Bibi's running around there, and I'm trying to stop her, and she's threatening to kill herself, it felt like it felt. Kind of shockingly like this was honouring a medieval world. And similarly, you know, the landscape is so familiar to us from Renaissance painting and stuff, what's going on in the background of those paintings. The agriculture seems to have not changed for hundreds of years. I mean, always when you're working in Italy, I think I've been lucky enough to work there 3 or 4 times, and each time the beauty of Italy is sometimes intimidating. The sheer aesthetic beauty of the world of Italy and the culture of Italy. It's fantastic to be around and to smell it, to see it, to taste it and touch it. But there's also a sense in which you hope that in some way you can meet it in what you're doing.
Excellent. Well, you can find Toby Jones as the King of High Hills amongst the beautiful Italian landscape in Tale of Tales, out on the 17th. Excellent.
Cheers.
Okay.
So we're now going to talk about the sort of the final acts of each story, and we're going to get into spoiler territory. So if you haven't seen the film, which is available on Curzon Home Cinema, highly recommend you do so, and then come back and listen to just what we thought about the film in a bit more detail. Okay, so I think let's talk about the Queen first of all, which I think has the weirdest, one of the weird twists. In that the Queen was the bat, which was like, okay. I also do think this is the most convoluted story, and for me was the weaker of the three.
The ending, I think, wraps up way too quickly.
Yeah, well, let's sort of backtrack. And so, I mean, there's some great visual. I think this had the best visuals. Like, you've got the sea monster, which is really beautifully designed. We mentioned Del Toro earlier, and it's a great sort of Del Toro-esque giant monster. I also love the diver's suit, like the massive tank that John C. Reilly's King gets into. Diver, that was a nice touch.
I loved that. I want one.
The albino twins as well, nicely designed. And the bat creature that is Salma Hayek was, again, a nice practical creation. It's just the fact that she becomes this bat creature was all a little bit, not confusing, just a bit much and just slightly convoluted, I thought, for me.
I thought that because in all of the ending of the story, the moral is always very difficult to reach. You really have to go home and really think about what the each and every story wants you to take back from it. I thought this one, I thought the ending, the two brothers, one of them running away, and then the other one following him because he sees through a fountain of their creation that he is in trouble. So the psychic link between the two of them personified, well, in kind of made into a fountain. I thought that was good, and it kind of stayed true to the original, even there were a lot of differences, as in the Queen isn't really included in this.
Okay.
But I thought Salma Hayek's character, the mother, the mother character needed to figure out that her violent desires towards one of these children was not going to be met with a happy ending for her, because she is the sole architect of her own misfortune. I think that's the kind of the moral of the story is, if something bad happens to you, you are its architect. You are the miserable being, and she is a miserable being.
Yeah,
I think throughout the entire story, you do feel, because when John C. Reilly dies, when her king dies.
Yeah.
He just exits the scene and there's no mourning. There's no true mourning period for her. So you can kind of see that her end is going to be a violent one. And
yeah, in that respect, it kind of makes sense that she would do this to, you know, I'm not sure the guy's name, the sort of the old man that is kind of gives her these.
The soothsayer.
Yeah. He tells her the sort of violence has to be solved by violence, that kind of thing. So it makes sense. It's just there's a lot of back and forth, I thought, with this one, but it is the visually, I think, is the most interesting. So then the flea, Helen, this is your favorite one.
Team flea.
The most sort of
Toby Jones nailed it.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. I think he's the strongest.
He's one of my favorite actors. I'm so jealous of Jake. But he was so good and so compelling to watch. And the flea, the design of the flea was hilarious.
Yeah, that's great. Really great design. Really quirky as well, this story, I thought. That king that loves just this little flea and goes back and he sort of plays around with it like it's a dog or something.
Yeah. And on a whim, gives out his daughter.
Yeah, that was quite a heartbreaking moment, really. That he tells her you have to do it and go marry the ogre.
But he kind of he was just too happy with himself.
Yeah.
Because he was enjoying his little game.
That no one's going to guess this as a flea.
And he was like, ah, ha, ha, ha. And then, obviously, it ended badly. Yeah. But he's just a fool, really.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. This one as well, I mean, the fact that, I mean, it's not shown, but it's heavily implied that the daughter is raped by the ogre. And the violence of the ogre, when the family come save them, he just rips their heads off pretty much. I mean, this was, I think, it got quite brutal in this one for a fairy tale.
And it changes as well, because in the original tale, it's the seven sons that save the daughter, and then they go back and they're bestowed riches, and the daughter finds another prince. This one,
the daughter's the hero. Yeah.
When she grabs the ogre's yeah. throat and kind of goes like this in the most unceremonial
just slits
of ways.
His throat, yeah.
I literally jumped off my seat. Yes, you go, girl. Yeah. You get your own. Absolutely. And the minute I saw that kind of change in narrative and yeah. how Garon kind of changed it, I was like, that is amazing. Any revisionist kind of treatment of fairy tales that came before that is pressing, yes, we need to give women back a certain role within fairy tales, comes across as so forced. This one,
yeah.
it came in the most natural of ways, because she uses her femininity to appease the ogre and then just cuts yeah. his throat. This is fantastic.
It was brilliant. There's a painting from Baroque times, mm-hmm. which that scene reminded
yeah.
me of,
okay.
Which is Judith beheading Holofernes.
Okay, great.
And Caravaggio did one as well. And I can't remember the woman who did it, which is terrible. Her name begins with a G and the rest has escaped me. But hers, a popular opinion is that hers is actually a lot better than Caravaggio's, mm-hmm. because Judith just is like very forceful
yeah.
and like, I know what I'm doing. And the scene where she carries the ogre's head to her father
mm-hmm. okay.
really reminded me of that painting.
Great. Yeah. Oh yeah, and she brings the head. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
it's insane. Yeah. And do you think it's hinted that one of the, I think it's Elias, is going to marry the daughter?
Yeah.
I think it seems...
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
But then he
it
dies,
doesn't matter.
So.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. She's got her crown.
Yeah,
she's
yeah.
got
fine.
A prince.
Exactly, yeah.
A courageous knight. She's got it. She's good.
And then finally, the two old women, which I believe is originally called the flayed woman.
The flayed old lady, I think, or the flayed woman.
Oh,
yeah.
This is insane. So you got this weird, the breastfeeding scene with the witch. I was like, where the hell is this going?
Mm-hmm.
And then just the end with the flayed woman was just brutal.
Shirley Henderson.
Yes, she
along with Toby Jones,
nailed it.
I think,
yeah.
were both absolutely living
yeah.
in their
That's
roles.
That's great casting as well.
Yeah.
I think this was kind of felt like a Baroque version of the Robert Zemeckis film Death Becomes Her.
Yay!
Kind
good
of
link,
the,
yeah.
sort of playing around with like, unnatural youth, which is always really interesting. And yeah, they do these women really doing anything they can to be young again,
yeah.
to reclaim their youth.
It was also I really love the moment where I will give you one
yes.
finger.
And she like, wraps it up and is so obsessed with it, and then it goes all red and she gets the other sister. Yeah.
They spend
yeah.
so much time kind
yeah.
of sucking it, trying to kind of get rid of all the wrinkles
yeah.
in that one little piece of body, that, and the king kind of falls completely for it. And then I thought Vincent Cassel's performance when he
yeah.
actually discovers that she is an old hag in his bed.
That was great.
Was wonderful.
Terrified.
Because again,
yeah.
he was, you could tell that king was so absolutely disgusted
yeah.
with himself. Mostly,
yeah.
That was a slightly strange plot device, where the reason the Shirley Henderson's character flays herself is because her sister, now younger, sort of as a kind of a joke or just an anger, says, "Oh, I had my skin flayed, and this new one grew back," and then she actually goes out and pays a guy to skin her. And one of the final shot of the story is her just sort of hobbling around the streets, and you see it quite clearly. Again, this is a shocking scene in a fairy tale. What you think of as a classic fairy tale. Yeah, a skinless Shirley Henderson. Absolutely brutal.
I think it depicts very well the downfall of being envious.
Yes.
Because that was a very... During the original author's time, envy, actually,
yeah.
in the court, was one of the... Like, one of the... Not one of the main sins, I would
okay.
say, of having at that time, like, being envious of somebody's riches, beauty, youth, and... Garone, again, these tales are not for the 18th century. They are for today. This
yeah.
is the messages that he brings us are as alive then, as alive today as
yeah.
as they were then. And it's amazing. And you're right, a flayed Shirley Henderson. And then,
yeah.
Right at the very end, you also have
the other sister.
Dora, I think her name
Dora,
was.
Yeah.
Played by Stacey Martin.
From Nymphomaniac,
yeah. whose youth starts to get away from
yeah.
her as well.
Yeah.
And she just leaves the scene completely.
Yeah, again, that's a nice fairy tale twist as well. That
yeah.
felt very natural, I think. So we're going to have to wrap up there, but any final thoughts? I mean, I'd just say that this is a really fun, bizarre film that sort of treads the line between fantasy, horror, surrealism. Really great watch. I think it's about 2 hours long, but mm-hmm. absolutely flew by for me.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. It's in cinemas, isn't it?
In cinemas on Friday and Curzon Home Cinema, absolutely.
Absolutely brilliant. And sorry if anything I said didn't make sense. I had a wisdom tooth that was falling. And earlier I thought Sam had bought a chopping board and it's a Prince vinyl.
We've all been there.
Oh, yeah. And I would leave people by saying just don't try. It's the same thing as Garon said. Don't try and understand it.
Mm.
Feel it. And he says, just feel it like when you're standing in front of a painting. Follow the characters, take the journey, feel the emotion. And I absolutely agree with him. There is no rhyme or reason in fairy tales. There never was. You just really have to go with the flow and enjoy the visuals as much as you would go in the Tate Modern to enjoy a painting. It's the same exact thing. You cannot find reasoning in this. Or if you try, then you really have to go home, think about it.
Yeah, and go back. I think it deserves a second watch, this film, as well.
Oh, yes, definitely.
I'm definitely going to go back and see it again, I think. Great. So that's a goodbye from me. Goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Mercy.
Later.
Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed. And we'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.